Hey guys, welcome back to another episode of The Dark Hustle. Thank you so much for listening to my podcast and subscribing and following us. It's super cool. You guys are the best. Also, if you are not a member of our Patreon, what are you doing? Go check it out. It's got multiple levels to choose from, and we have early access over there for all of our episodes and a bunch of other stuff. So go check us out on Patreon.
Yeah, I'm in North Carolina, which it gets pretty hot here, but not like Texas heat.
Yeah. We get hot and humid.
Yes, yes. So let me just go ahead and get started into this. So you guys are, you and your wife, you are a all-around trainer, and your wife is a vet.
Mostly correct. So I basically just train for the ranch classes now. Mm-hmm. I used to do a lot more of the all-around stuff, and everything for me has just focused the last several years on specifically just doing the ranch classes. And then, yes, the second part of that, my wife, yes, she's an equine vet, works out of a place called Great Plains
Arcadia.
And it's a really, really nice place to work, and she got good boss and good staff over there, and like she really enjoys being over there.
Yeah. Now, are you originally from, are you guys in Oklahoma or Texas? Where are you at?
Oklahoma. So we're Oklahoma. In a little town called Jones, which is about 20 minutes northeast of the Oklahoma City Fairgrounds.
Yeah. So now, are y'all born and raised there?
I am from here, yes. I'm was born in Edmond, which is just north of Oklahoma City. And but Grace, she is originally from Birmingham, Alabama.
So what did you do to pull her out of Alabama?
Well, she came here. I didn't get her here, but I kept her here once I found her. She came out here after vet school. She moved out here to do an internship year, and then she ended up staying out here, and we met shortly. Well, we met kind of at the end of her internship year.
Yeah.
And then she ended up staying on with that clinic as an associate, and the rest is history, I guess, as they say. But
now, we already talked about this before. So you are primarily ranch now, but you do come from, I believe you said you came from team roping into all around, into ranch.
Kind of backwards. So I started off, my parents raised and trained and showed Appaloosas. And so that was my childhood.
And they are not crazy, by the way.
No. There's some good ones. There's some really good ones.
I had a 30-year-old app. She was a bay. She had no color, but she was a bay. She was registered because she had the molt and the white hooves and the stripes on the hooves and stuff. I showed app back in the day. And that's all you ever heard people say. They would clown them. Apps are crazy. No, they're not.
Well, I think they kind of get a bad rap. And I'll say this.
Yeah.
I think part of that is, you know, there's good horses in all breeds. And there's bad horses in all breeds. And the thing about the apps that I think what makes that stick with you, the loud color, when you see one act a fool, it just kind of sticks out in your head. If you see just a plain sorrel, quarter horse, act like an idiot, you don't really think much about it, right? You see so many of them. But when somebody shows up and they've got a loud colored Appaloosa and that thing, and it's bad, then you know, I think that's kind of where some of that comes from.
Yeah.
And of course now, you know, what Appaloosas were in the 70s and 80s and into the 90s has changed so much. There's so much quarter horse genetics involved in that now. You know, and since
they're a lot more all around too, like you see them doing a lot more stuff.
You do. That's one thing the Appaloosas have always been pretty prided themselves on, was the versatility of these horses and the fact that they could go and do a multitude of different events and do them all pretty well. And so you still see that a lot where people will be running at the high points on a lot of one horse, one rider type scenarios where they have a horse that they take and they'll take it in the pleasure. They'll take it in the hunt seat. They'll take it and do the jumping and the showmanship. And then they'll go enter it in the barrels or the pole class or something like that. And so that was certainly the way it was whenever I was a kid, and all the high points were one horse, one rider. And that kind of brings me back to, like, so my parents raised the Appaloosas, and we showed, me and my sister, that was our whole childhood, was we showed all the time. I mean, we were going a lot, and we did everything. You know, it was every, if it was an offered class, we tried it, you know, and we would do a lot of them, everything, you know. Showmanship, horsemanship, pleasure. I did the jumping. I did the barrels and poles. I did some reining. I did the roping. I did.
Oh, wow. You did jumping? Whoa. Pump the brakes.
Yep.
You don't hear a lot of guys do jumping.
Yep. So that was my mom's thing. My mom was a jumper. There's actually a really cool photo we have of her jumping when she was pregnant with me.
Oh, wow.
She was actually jumping, and pretty good size fence. You know, that one was probably around 5 feet, and she had a really, really nice mare that did the jumping, and she won a lot on her. And so it's kind of, you know,
you,
we joke
that
I've been riding since before I was born. Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no way it didn't, you know? And so it was a big deal in our house to, even if it's kind of, was kind of like food, you may not like it, but you're going to try it.
Yeah.
You know, really, the only thing that I never showed in, I never did saddle seat. That was really about the only class that they offered. I mean, I did the bareback equitation, I did trail, I did all of it. I never did do the saddle seat. My sister did that, but I never did that one.
I always thought the trail classes were, like, not what a real trail is.
Well,
but they're fun. So,
what's interesting is that if you go back, like when I was a kid, what the trail courses were then were really not that far off from what we do now in the ranch classes. You know, there was always a gate, there was always a bridge, you know, you'd have a trot over element, turn around in a box, you know, side pass, back through an L. We still do a lot of that same stuff. You know, the regular trail or city trail, like some people call it, That's morphed into a whole other creature. And I mean, it takes a really, really special horse and a pretty darn good trainer to make one of those horses that can compete at a really high level, because there's so much control required. I mean, you've got to be able to lengthen stride, shorten stride. You've got to be able to pretty much control every footfall to make sure that foot lands where you want it to land. And there's a lot of training. I have a lot of respect for the guys that are really good at that, and gals.
Yeah.
But anybody who can train one to that level, to do that, that takes some doing. It takes a lot of patience and a long time, and I have a lot of respect for those guys.
Well, and it's hard to actually mimic a good trail course. Like, I mean, it takes a lot of money and time, because I think there was a post on the internet a while back, this trail challenge that happens like out in Oregon or something, and the course is insane. I mean, like, they bring in water and limbs. Like, it is not what
that,
you and
actually,
I are, and most people are used to. It's very, very intense.
It's pretty much an outdoor scene brought into that indoor arena.
Yeah.
I mean, they bring in dirt, and they plant trees in there, and they build a creek through it, and I mean, there's hills and little rock ledges that you have to go down, and I'd be curious to know how long it takes them to set that up. I bet a 2-3 week deal leading into that to get all that done. They must have
what I was just saying, like, your normal show already takes a long amount of time now that you can't afford. You know, an association can't afford to spend 2 days to put on, you know, what you think would be a trail. But then again, the trail classes that we're talking about, just your, like, city trail, like you said it, they're still hard. They're not, you know, it might look easy, but they're still hard.
Oh, yeah. I mean, if you want to challenge yourself at some point, just pull one of those trail patterns from, like, the World Show and just try to memorize it. not even just doing it, just remembering it and where you have to go and where everything cuts back through. I mean, they're very long, and there's a lot to it for sure.
So you went from, you grew up, your parents are all up into the horse world, and so you were around it growing up, but I believe you said that you went into team roping first, right?
As I got older, that was kind of, you know, late teens and all through my 20s and most of my 30s, that was kind of the main focus for me was team roping, going to rodeos and the bigger jackpot ropings, things like that. I kind of stepped away from the horse show world there for a while. You know, to be real honest, mostly just because as a, you know, 20-something-year-old, I couldn't afford it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's very expensive. And, you know, I just kind of having to make my own way in the world, and it just wasn't something that I could afford to do. They didn't have near as much opportunity for payback money as they do now, you know. Like, that was one thing. I could go and I could do the rodeos and the team roping and I could win money back, and so it wasn't 100% just out the door as a loss. And so that was really the main reason I kind of steered that direction, was really just lack of opportunity to do it a different way.
Which, you just made me think about something, and I don't know if you agree with this or not, but I'm kind of glad that these shows are starting to bring money into an aspect of it, because I think that generates a lot more people to come to it. Because, you know, like back in the day, like you could probably say this, you didn't have payouts. You didn't go to a horse show to get money. You know, you went to a horse show just to, like, sweat all day and show your horse off and get a ribbon, not downplaying it. But it's nice that there's some money involved. I mean, some of these snaffle bit shows down there in Florida and stuff, one of them has like a $25,000 payout.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's for the futurity or not, but for one of the snaffle bit futurities or not, but I'm like, holy crap.
Yeah. Yeah. So the Appaloosa Ranch Horse Association puts on a ranch futurity for 3-year-olds at the World Show. And I believe it was at 5,000 added last year. I think they're supposed to be that again this year.
Jeez.
You know, and the International Ranch Horse Association that Daniel Patton's put together, like, they're doing a great deal with their futurities. I'm pretty sure that one pays around $15,000 or something like that last year, and pays pretty deep. And then they have the Ranch Horse Triple Crown that, again, Daniel's doing, and those are, I think, about $10,000 per division, pretty close to that last year, give or take. And so, you know, you can go to a show and you can do well, and you can come home with more than you spent.
Yeah.
Now, that's not always the case. You know, if for everybody that wins, somebody loses. It's kind of like the casino, but
right,
at the end of the day, you do it's at least a possibility, you know. And for many, many years, you know, there were a few halter futurities and a few 2-year-old futurities and you know, snaffle bit type deals, but nothing nearly like what we're looking at today. And the money just across the board has grown, and the reining, the cutting, cow horse, all of it, the ranch, and even just your regular show classes. I mean, there's so much more money available, and it's really great to see, you know, all of that. That's all sponsor money, you know. That's all people pulling together trying to build the industry, and companies being willing to step up and put up money. And you know, that's really encouraging to see that the industry is moving that direction, and it's definitely a positive trend. And, you know, hopefully everything continues that way and things just continue to grow and get better.
Do you think that it's going to – well, obviously it spiked up because of Yellowstone. I think we talked about this earlier, you know, spiked up because of Yellowstone and all that kind of stuff. Do you think it's going to go – back down, or do you think the industry is going to stay changed forever?
You know, that's a good crystal ball type question. I wish I knew the answer to that, because I could probably double down and figure out a way to make some money out of it. But
right.
I think truthfully, just my personal opinion, you know, and I could be wrong.
Right.
I think it will come back down, but I think the floor has been raised kind of forever, if that makes sense. I don't think it's going to drop back down probably ever to the point that it was 15 years ago. you know, I think that we have lifted the floor enough that it's still going to be good. I think what you're going to see is, you know, instead of 105 entries in the, you know, at the World Show and the amateur, you're going to have 65, you know, or 70. Mm-hmm. I think it'll drop, but I don't think it's just going to completely fall apart, if that makes sense. I think something really drastic would have to happen, you know, in the economy for it to go and just completely fall apart and go back to the old days, you know. And I've coming from Oklahoma, and I'm old enough, I remember kind of what we called the, when the oil boom went bust and Penn Square Bank folded here, and like it was a big hit. I think that was maybe
when was this
like 1986, maybe 85 86. I was young, but my mother, she had a business, she's an accountant, she had a firm that did a lot of oil and gas accounting and stuff, and mm-hmm. so we felt that really, really hard when all that happened, because it just, so many of the independents went out of business with that, you know, and
right.
the big companies, massive layoffs, and it was a big hit. And for Oklahoma's economy, you know, the oil and gas industry, that's the big one for us here. And so our state economy, I mean, it took a big hit, but there were still horse shows, you know, there were still entries, things went down maybe a little bit, but it was still big, you know, it didn't completely kill it. And as long as people have some discretionary income, they're going to spend it somewhere. And, you know, as well as I do, horses are an addiction. Like
yeah.
once you kind of get that, you know, once you get the bug, and it's hard to walk away from, you know, it's kind of like a drug. And
they're children. They're like children to some people. They're not like, I mean.
Oh, absolutely. You know. Absolutely. Absolutely. There are people, there's an attorney here locally that her entire business is setting up trusts for horses and dogs, like animal trusts, so that when people leave money, they leave it in the trust, name a trustee, and then the trust pays out for board and vet care and whatever it needs to pay for in perpetuity.
Oh, wow.
Till it either runs out of money or till the animal passes. And like, that's her entire business. Like, it, you know, there's a lot of people that are doing
yeah.
that now, because they care enough about these animals. They want to ensure that they're taken care of if something happens to them.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you are right there in the middle of, I mean, you're right there in the heart of, I've talked about this before with people that are like in Pennsylvania and East Coast, even in Florida and stuff. You know, you guys in Oklahoma and Texas are in the heart of it. Like, you are in the heart of it. That's all that's there. So that would make sense for her to be, you know, to have that as her business. But I don't think maybe people realize how saturated you guys are out there. Like, it's thick out there, right?
It is. There are a lot of horses, and there are a lot of horses doing a lot of different things out here. You know, the barrel racing here is huge. The team roping is huge. The mounted shooting is really big out here. Of course, all your traditional horse stuff's big out here. You know,
yeah.
with the AQHA World Show being in Oklahoma City, that draws a lot of people into that deal. But really, you know, I've kind of been around seeing every different aspect of this, and you know, I'd love to see some statistics on it, but I think the ranch stuff has probably been the biggest growth that we've seen. The reining, really, I mean, it's doing well, but it's always done well, and you know, it's growing for sure. But the ranch, I mean, we're looking at like a lot of these shows are doubling in numbers year to year to year. You know, so what, they went years, several years, and they might have 20 entries. Now they got 40, and, you know, next year maybe 50 or 60. Like, it's just the uptick in the ranch stuff is really big. And I think that's because it's accessible to so many people.
We talked about this before now. You and I talked about this. I completely agree. It's expensive to ride cutters. It's not, I'm just going to be honest. Reiners are kind of the same way. It's not a cheap hobby to ride reining horses. And ranch, I think, gives people a economic edge to be able to do a lot more with it. Helps what you're saying. Your average person that wants to get into horses in some way,
absolutely,
shape, or form.
Absolutely.
A doorway to get in.
Absolutely. And I know, in terms of like your cutting, it's so expensive to do cutting because it is so expensive to put on a cutting. And it's expensive to train cutting horses. Just the sheer number of cattle you have to have is, and that costs money. And there's just not a great way around that. I love cutting. I think it's a really fun thing to watch. It does take a little bit more money to kind of go that route. The reining, kind of same deal. I mean, you have to have good footing. You can't just call down, or you shouldn't just call down to the local sand pit and say, here, come dump some sand on top of this flat spot. Like, you need to prepare a base, and you need, if you really want to do it right, you need to call in a specialist to come in and to set all that up for you, and then buy the right kind of equipment to maintain it, and a good drag for that, you're going to spend a pretty good amount of money. And so that adds to that same thing, the NRHA, they bring in Jim Kaiser to do their big events and to get the footing right. And that costs money, and that's all just part of it, but that also is reflected in the payouts, the reining payouts in the reining and in the cutting and even the cow horse now, they're still way bigger than what any of the money we're running at for the ranch horse stuff, or even really, any of your traditional show classes. The halter fraternities have got some pretty big money in them now, but it's still not touching like what your fraternity winners are going to win for the cow horse, the cutting, or the reining. Trending that way. But the other thing is, those events, they do take a certain amount of physical ability, physical fitness. And I have riders doing the ranch stuff. My youngest is almost 7. And then my oldest is 68. And then everywhere in between on that spectrum. And so there's not a lot of things out there, not to say that someone at 68 can't go do cutting or can't go do cow horse, because they certainly can and they do, but it's a much smaller pool of people who at that age can physically go and do those things. The ranch classes allows people to continue to be active, to continue to participate in the horse industry. And in a way that is fun, showing the ranch horses is fun, and for the most part, a really good group of people. I mean, everywhere we go, the people that show in the ranch classes, they seem to be super down to earth, and everybody kind of gets along. And I was having a conversation. I was just at the Pinto World Show, and I was talking to Sid Zacharias. He's the trainer that's kind of up towards Tulsa. And we were sitting talking about it. And, both of us kind of have the same philosophy on it, is that we're not there competing against each other. We're there kind of competing against ourselves. And it's with ranch riding, scored class. So we're trying to improve on whatever we laid down at the last show. We're going to try to improve on that and do better at this show. And we were both talking about kind of the camaraderie within, like, especially within the trainer group. Like, if one of the other trainers goes down and just really lays down a good run, I mean, the rest of us, we're not like sitting over there going, oh dang, I'm not gonna be able to get around that, or that's gonna be hard to beat. We're kind of more like, dang, that was good, like, good for you. Because it's hard. There's so many there's a million different little things that can go wrong in a ranch riding pattern, and one thing gets you into a penalty, and you can go from first to nothing real fast. And so when somebody goes out and they really attack a pattern trying to win something, and it all comes together, like, we know how hard it is to make that happen. And I think we all kind of root for each other a little bit in that way. Mm-hmm. And, you know, because it's a rare thing when you see a flawless, perfect pattern where everything was just on point.
Yeah. Now, wait. Now, hold on. So you were at you were doing this at the Pinto World, right? Now, the Pinto World is it's not strictly ranch related. Obviously, they have pleasure and hunt seat. They have all kinds of stuff going on out there, right?
Yes.
This is just the ranch portion of the Pinto World, right?
Yeah. Okay. Yes, ma'am.
Okay, that's what I was thinking, because you got me to thinking about, you mentioned the International Ranch Association, and then, you know, the American Ranch Horse Association or whatever, and they have their own world show and stuff like that. The incentives that are set, doesn't Daniel have a couple of incentives that he's placed within the paint?
Yeah.
Is that
so
right?
So that show runs in conjunction, like, in kind of inside the paint world.
Okay. This is what I want to know.
and the Ranch Triple Crown. So those all run at the Paint World Show, which just started. And so when you go there, there's a 3-year-old futurity that is part of the International Ranch Horse Association. You can also enter what they call the Ranch Horse Triple Crown, which is ranch riding, ranch rail pleasure, and ranch trail. Each one of those runs as its own class, and then there's an overall. So if somebody were to go win all three of those, there's an additional. It's like winning the Triple Crown, basically. So then there's an additional payout for that.
Oh,
and
cool.
what they've done on that is they've kind of mimicked what some of the other industries are doing, and so there's actually like stallion owner incentives and things within the futurity and the Triple Crown stuff. So if you are the owner breeder of one that somebody else owns and they show it and they win, you're still going to get a check. And so that adds a whole other layer of incentive, you know, trying to promote people maybe thinking about actually breeding horses specifically for these events. Currently the majority of the horses, the majority of the horses that you see showing now, a lot of them started as reiners, started as cow horses, and for one reason or another weren't going to kind of cut the mustard, if you will, in those venues. Typically it's because they're either kind of lacking in one particular skill, or they just don't have enough, like they're just not dynamic enough, they don't have a big enough motor, don't have enough run, whatever it may be. You know, I've seen several that have kind of crossed over that, you know, really good lead changer, really good turner, terrible stopper, just not a good stopper.
Right.
You know, that's kind of one deficiency, but the way that we stop these horses for the ranch horse classes is not nearly the same as what they do. So if you just can have a horse that, you know, maybe will kind of ride up to it and make a good move and just go to the ground pretty hard. They don't have to travel anywhere. They don't need to slide, you know, 30 feet. In fact, you don't really want them to, because a lot of times that's a stop into a turn at a lope off or something like that. And if they have an excessive amount of slide, you got a problem.
Right.
And so it's actually discouraged a little bit for them to go at a stop like that. But there's a lot of them.
So how long do you think you need as a trainer to get you an overall, a pretty good, like on a scale from 1 to 10, like an 8-ish ranch horse, all around ranch horse done? Like, how long do you normally take, depending on, of course, it's all dependent on the horse, you know, and how fast they move and learn and things of that nature. But on average, how long does it normally take you to get one?
That's a tough thing to answer. Again, you know, like you said, they are all individuals and they all come along at a different pace. And then the question is, you know, did we start this horse as a 2-year-old? You know, and did it come where we started it in January, or did it come and we didn't get it till August of its 2-year-old year and get it started? But my typical rule of thumb, this is kind of what I tell my customers and I tell my amateur riders, if you have a green horse like that, say you got 2 or 3-year-old, you can really expect that you're probably going to need to campaign that horse, you know, I'd say a year of training minimum before you show it, and then a year of showing minimum before I would say that it's not, they're not finished. They're never finished. I don't think any horse is ever finished. There's always things to improve on and to make better, but to at least be what I would consider, you know, relatively seasoned. I generally try to keep those horses. I'd like to keep them all through the end of their junior year. So, you know, keep them through as 5-year-olds and then as 6-year-olds, if they want to take them home, then that's something that we can kind of send them home. They could come back for tune-ups or they could haul in for lessons or whatever. But, you know, I've made several good ones, and really good ones that, you know, even with them already having a pretty good amount of training when I got them, it's still about a 2-year process before I feel like they're super, super solid.
Yeah. No, I know it's hard to put an exact date. You can't, because obviously you're working with another living, breathing thing. You can't, you're not on your own time scale with that, but it's kind of cool to get like a ballpark figure, of course, depending on what you're working with. Now, do you guys, raise your own there and train your own there and things of that nature? Or do you just strictly stick to customers' horses and boarders and things like that?
We have a few. I don't have a large breeding program. For me, I have a couple of mares, and you know, we try to keep that part of it relatively small. You know, there's a lot of people with a lot smarter than me, with a lot more money than me, that can go out and make them a lot fancier and a lot nicer than what I can create. But I do have a couple of mares that were really good mares. I've got one that's a producer that I have 2 full siblings out of her that are both multiple time world champions. And so we have a weanling on the ground out of that mare and a different stud. And then she is bred back to another one that'll be a full sibling to those 2. And then my other mare, we couldn't get her settled this year, so we finally decided to stop as it was getting pretty late in the year. So we may circle back and try to breed her again. I do have a 2-year-old and a yearling out of that mare that are both pretty nice.
So we got some prospects.
Yeah. So the sire on the 2, and then the 2-year-old is Gunner on Ice that Tammy Hutton has. And we've had a lot of success on those. And then the yearling that I have is FM Cottonwood is the sire on that one. And they're both out of a daughter of Done It With a Twist that the McQuays bred. And she's a pretty nice mare. And so we do a few, but we keep it pretty small and pretty streamlined. And,
right,
you know, I'm fortunate enough that my barn stays full with mostly customer horses. And so a lot of it's just lack of room for places to put them and lack of time for training more of them. But I'm not opposed. I think there's a lot of different paths to get to the same place, you know. And
yeah,
there's so many good prospects out there that, you know, well, it all kind of depends on what your passion is. Some people really enjoy the kind of the game of pedigrees and bloodlines and trying to figure out like what's going to be the next magic cross.
We talked about this last time.
We did. And some people are like me, and I'm just like, okay, like we bred that mare. Like we've got 2 world champions out of her. So we're going to breed her back. We're just going to go to that same well again because it was proven. Like, we know that'll work.
Yeah.
And a lot of people will do that as well. I think we're starting to see where people are starting to kind of try to find outcross stuff to figure out, you know, what's going to be the next – who's going to be the next Gunner, you know, in the reigning is kind of the big question. Like, that horse was – just he completely changed that industry. And, you know, it's Gunner kind of, I mean, The only other horse I can think of that had that prolific of an impact in the horse industry is basically, like, with Impressive and the halter.
Yeah.
You know, there's like, it just changed the way the horses looked, you know, and we won't get down the road of, like, the HYPP and all that, but it changed.
We could take a curveball on that, because it is wild to see all of the crazy, because, well, you can agree with this, like, back in the day, you didn't have tests for that stuff. Like, it was really a gamble. It's not much of a gamble now. You can call a place up, and they can literally test for your gait range, I mean, and speed for these horses. So it's wild how much that has grown, and it's crazy.
Absolutely. The technology has completely changed the game. I mean, what you're able to do, and we talked about this before, where they, you know, we have studs that have been deceased for a long time, like several years, and they're still able to go in and create more offspring, and the utilization of the efficiency with which they can do that, and they can utilize so much less semen now, using all the ICSI and all that stuff. Like, it's crazy to think about. When I was a kid, you know, and I'm 44, almost 5, and that's not that long ago, really, but 30 years ago, very few people were even doing artificial insemination.
Oh, like, God, no.
Almost all live cover back then. So to go from where we've gone in 30 years from mostly live cover to now, you know, being able to do all the stuff. I mean, it is, you know, you can have one superstar mare and you can flush her and you can end up having multiple babies out of that same mare. I mean, it's crazy how far all that's come. And it'll be interesting to see what does it look like in 30 more years, you know, you might be able to custom order up exactly, you know, down to hair coat, eye color, gender. You know?
Well, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and actually I think now live cover is kind of considered more dangerous. It's like if you look back in the day, like what you just said, that's all everybody did. And now with so much technology available, live cover is not, it's shrinking down. People don't want to do it as much because it can be dangerous. Why would you want to handle all of that and do all of that and deal with all that when you could literally, like what you just said, call them up and order what you want?
Yeah. Yeah. I think the jockey club still requires, so for thoroughbreds, I think they required to be live cover still, but I think just about every other one, at least that I know of, has gone to allowing all of the AI and all that stuff.
Oh, I wonder why they would restrict that. Do you know?
I do not. I do not know. But a lot of that, I think it's horse racing. So much of that is just tradition.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Okay.
Everything's tradition, and that's just the way it was done, and the way, you know, hard to change, you know, when it's like that. But it is definitely, I mean, it can be dangerous. My parents owned a stud, really nice stud, when I was a kid, that he covered a mare, and she wasn't having it, and she kicked him, and she broke his leg. And we had to put him back. Like, that can happen, you know?
Yeah.
It can happen real quick. And so, you know, I do think it's safer. It allows for the ability to breed more mares.
Yeah.
Each year. A stud can only live cover so many mares and get them bred, you know. But, you know, if your stud's fertile enough, then, you know, you could do collections on, you know, 3 times a week and be sending out viable semen for multiples of mares each time.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of them do. And, you know, so that has changed the industry a lot as well, just the ability to do that. And so when the people do find kind of like the magic cross, you know, you can make more of them much more efficiently.
Well, yeah, that's like you were talking about you know, when we talked last time, you know, what, how are you to know what's going to be that next amazing animal that's going to change the thing, you know, the industry altogether? And I mean, how are you supposed to know? And even mares now, I think it's really cool that mares are getting a lot more recognition than they did earlier in the industry, you know, in the times where you grew up and I grew up, nobody really cared about the mare. I mean, not saying that like mean or anything, but it was not near as much emphasis. Whereas now the mare is way up there in value and regard to these, you know, when people are picking out studs and picking out what they're going to do and stuff, which is super cool.
Yeah. I personally believe it's the more important of the two.
Mm.
Honestly, in my opinion, I think what kind of mare you're working with is far more important. And I could go into detail on why, you know, nature, nurture, all that kind of stuff, because the mare, then you got both. The mare's the one that raises that baby. The mare's the one that's going to either, you know, be a good mom or not be a good mom, you know.
No, you are right. No, you're very, very right. I would like to hear what you think about that. Because, Bill, and the only reason why I say this, because I don't have nowhere near as much, like, history or experience when it comes to breeding horses, but we did breed the one that I rode my whole life and raised her, and they will reject a foal. Like, you can have some bad mamas out there, and her mama ran her ragged. We ended up having to just, like, separate them. And I don't think people realize that can happen.
Oh, absolutely. And I've seen it go the other way too, where the mom is a good mom, but she's so passive that you've got this little terror of a foal that just paws her and rears up on her and bites her and kicks her and, you know, just is relentless in how it behaves. And when the mare doesn't kind of put that foal in its place, you've got a foal that then has those tendencies.
Issues.
When it transitions from being weaned from her to you trying to work with it, it's going to think that's kind of how relationships are supposed to work. And it can definitely make a trainer's job harder to have to deal with one that's that way. It's the same thing as if you take someone that raises a foal and they overlove it, as I say, and, you know, kind of like almost treat it like a dog instead of treating it like a horse, then it can make the trainer's job a lot harder as well, because they lose the boundaries, personal space. They don't, like, those are the horses that'll just walk up and stick their face right in your face. And, you know, they don't have the parameters that they need to understand about staying out of my space and so forth and so on. But, you know, I think the mare has a lot to do with it. The genetics of the mare has a lot to do with it. We've also kind of reached a stage where there are so many good stallion options that it's easier, in my opinion, to find a quality stud to breed to than it is to get your hands on a quality mare.
Yeah.
Those are harder to come by.
Yeah, I can see that.
Mm-hmm. You know, those are harder to come by. And the industry recognizes that too now. I mean, you can buy embryos. There'll be people that have a mare and, you know, she might have won out 100,000 or whatever, and they'll sell embryos. Because you can't afford a mare of that caliber, but you could afford the embryo and put it in a recip mare. And that's kind of becoming a thing that we're seeing more and more in the industry as well. But I think there's been some really good mares over the years that probably did not get nearly as much credit as they should have. But I think part of that, I think, is it's the marketing. You know, you have to market these stallions, and there's so many of them and so many people invested in the success of these studs that the marketing machine kind of gets in there. And that's just what you hear all the time is, you know, breed to this stud, his baby did this, it won this, blah, blah, blah. And so it kind of makes you think about that aspect of it more, because that's what you're hearing more.
Yeah,
but
that's very true.
The mare power is a big deal, in my opinion, for sure.
Yeah. Well, and that's funny you brought up the recip mare, ordeal, because I don't know if they did this in the past or not. To me, I feel like it's a very new thing, but it blows my mind that you're able to do that. I mean, because, like, well, with us humans, you can have a surrogate mother. Why would it not be that weird to do it with horses? But a lot of people are taking advantage of that. You know, you could pop out more babies with recip mares.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, that is that's the whole deal. And then, you know, there's a couple sides to that. One, like we talked about, you flush a mare, you might be able to have one mare that has two foals, and those are both carried by recip mares, and that mare's still going to the horse show.
You don't have to
put them on a shelf because they're bred. You can still continue to show that horse and haul that horse, and then the recip mares can carry the foals to term. You don't, you know, complications of labor. I mean, mares do have complications. It can be fatal, just like with people, and it does happen. And, you know, if you've got a super nice producer mare, and you got the money to pay to do that and have the recips and all that, then why even risk it? Why risk having them try to carry it to term when you've got someone over here, you know, got a horse over here that you can put that in? And so it's all just almost a little bit of an insurance policy that, you know, you're not putting that risk on that horse that, you know, that you want to be able to breed for years. And so it's a smart way to do it. And to be real honest, I mean, it adds value to the mares that, you know, I hate to say weren't any good, but maybe didn't get the best shot in life, or maybe had some kind of injury or whatever that limited their ability to have a performance career. You know, what do you do with those mares at that point? You know,
right?
You could breed them, but just breed them directly. But what if they're not necessarily pedigreed that well? What if they're, you know, not really what you would be looking for to make, say, a reining horse, you know?
Right.
I mean, there's several that use all kinds of different breeds as well. You know, say you want to just specifically create Appaloosas, but there's three paint mares standing there. Well, then you've got no use for them. But if you can use them as recips, then you got a use for them.
Right.
And so, you know, it's not necessarily a bad thing, and it takes those mares. And, you know, I've yet to meet anybody that had a bunch of recip mares that didn't take really good care of them, because they're carrying really expensive babies most of the time. So they're going to make sure that they're fed, they're vaccinated, they're dewormed, you know, they're going to at least try to keep up with trimming their feet and stuff. You know, they take care of them because they got precious cargo, you know. If you don't take care of the host, you're not going to have a viable foal. And so, you know, those mares get a pretty good life. They get taken care of, they get fed well, and get everything that they need. And, you know, that prevents those horses from, you know, a lot of those might end up on a feed lot somewhere, you know?
Well, yeah. And now you just made me think about something, well, with what we're talking about, and I don't want to lose my train of thought, but back to Gunner and back to, you know, how do we know what's going to be the next best thing, whether it be a stud or a mare? You know, what bloodlines do you see now that are out in the show pen, getting dirty and showing? Which ones do you think may have that potential to be that next great thing? You know, which ones do you guys particularly like?
Well, that's a tough question, too, because it kind of depends on what avenue you're talking about. You know, or if you're talking about, Like the Gunners, truthfully, a lot of the Gunners don't make the best ranch horses because, A, a lot of them aren't very nice lopers. And that's nothing against them. They're great reiners. They're huge stoppers and all that. But, you know, they don't necessarily always carry themselves at the lope the way you'd want one to. And so, you know, for what we're doing within the ranch stuff, there, you know, there's a few different things. The Magnum Chick Dream horses are usually really good lopers, and that's one of the things we look for. Sp- Spooks Got a Whiz. There's quite a few Spooks Got a Whiz that are doing really well. SG Frozen
Enterprise. I've seen that ad.
Yeah, SG Frozen Enterprise, that's one that has been making some, had some babies that have been starting to do well within the ranch classes. But, I mean, it really kind of comes from all over. There's not, it's still new enough that there's not any one sire that's really kind of stepped up as like the go-to, you know, in order to be able to kind of to guess which way that's going to be, that's going to be a hard thing to forecast. And, you know, it's going to be, somebody out there has a plan, and, you know, several somebodies have plans, and they're going to kind of go probably try to breed specific down that route. And then, you know, we talked about this before with the way the industry is now. I mean, it's not enough to just have a stud that won something.
Right.
They gotta have won something. They've got to get proven as a producer. You know, nobody wants like the secretariat deal where, you know, secretariat won everything and his offspring didn't hardly win anything. He was a phenomenal horse, but not a great sire. And we've seen in the past where there were some of these horses that won less and ended up being really good sires, right? Like maybe they didn't win 300,000, but they turned out to be really, really good sires. But now it almost seems like we're at a point where it's kind of, you got to kind of have what I call the Trinity. they got to have won a lot, and they've got to be a producer. And then the foals, you also then have to have like the movement. Like, and even in the reining, there's a trend starting to go towards rewarding quality of movement.
Yeah.
So when they come down and do their small, slow circle, they want it slow, but they want it to be a true three-beat lope. And, you know, they're going to reward those horses that can really lope slow, but really lope correct at the same time and not get four-beaty and shuffly. And so, you know, they kind of have to have all that and pretty. I mean, we're at a point now where they got to be pretty. And if you want to have a shot to win, you know, you're not seeing a lot of just plain sorrels winning like we did, you know, back in the 80s. And, you know, a little bit more so in the cutting. I think you can get away with that because just the way that job has to be done. They, I mean, again, a million things can go wrong when they're trying to show on like the cutting fraternity or something, but you know, it's just the aesthetics have always mattered, but I think they're starting to matter more and more and more and more because they have to have some way to separate out. You know, it's not nearly as hard from a judge's perspective to place a class of 20 as this place a class of 100.
Right.
You know, there's got to be something that makes that horse pop and stand out and gets that judge's attention when they see you ride in the pen and go, oh, look at that one. And it kind of gets them almost anticipating, waiting, hoping that this beautiful horse is actually going to work that well too.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you can't, I mean, pretty is pretty does.
Oh, for sure.
Yeah, you got to make sure that it's not just pretty. But that's funny that you say all of that because, you know, like from the pleasure perspective of it, like we talked about earlier, you know, the outfits and stuff versus what's kind of required in the ranch world, I think that's what is making not just that, but the movement of the horse. You know, back in the day, pleasure horses didn't move natural. They still don't, but I think that the ranch environment and show is a lot more, you know, people want to do it because the horse can be a little more natural and there's not so much pressure to have to spend, you know, what did we say, $30,000, $25,000 on a saddle and an outfit, which is insane. And
yeah, it can get really pricey really fast on that. You know, some of those Dale Chavez or Harris saddles, I mean, they're very expensive. And then, you know, with the show outfits and then you know, all the girls, they're like, oh, they wear it once and they win something and there's pictures and then, oh, I can't wear that one anymore. And so then they like swap with a friend or they, you know, there's a lot of resale.
He's not wrong.
Where they buy it and they sell it, you know. That's a whole thing. I mean, I know some girls that have some stuff and they like rent it out. They rent out those show clothes because it is very expensive and it's very much,
That's a good idea.
It's very much one of those things where you just can't just keep showing like I do. So I show in a black shirt a lot and I've got several of them, but I kind of stumbled into that, like in the ranch riding. I was just kind of wearing whatever for a while. And then I wore a black shirt and I won at a really big show. And so then the next big show I went to, I made sure I wore that same black shirt and I won again. And so then it kind of snowballed into this thing. I'm like, okay, so in ranch riding, I wear a black shirt. It just seems to be a good luck deal, right? But I can do that in the ranch class. I can do that in the ranch class. You're not going to see where this, you know, a girl's going to show up and win the horsemanship at the Quarter Horse World Show every year wearing the exact same outfit. Like, that's probably not happening. And, you know, so much of that is, again, about the visual aesthetics and all that. But it can get very expensive over there very, very quickly. And, you know, the ranch is not – the ranch deal, I always tell everybody, you can spend as much as you want to in the ranch.
Right.
I mean, you can get real pricey if you want to. But you don't have to. You know, I have had clients that come in, you know, and they've got a saddle that's functional. You know, it doesn't look bad, but it's not fancy. But it gets the job done. And, you know, they might have paid – you know, $2,000 for it and or bought it used for $1,500 or something. And it does what they need it to do, you know, for me, as long as it fits your horse well and it's, you know, it's made out of quality material. That's really about all that matters. It's not necessarily that it has to be a certain brand. I have a preference that I use because it fits most of my horses and most of my customers are riding those saddles and stuff now. But that's more my personal preference, not necessarily to say that one's better than the other, but that's what I like and what I have found has worked for me on a variety of different horses. And I show, I've got apps, I've got quarters, I've got a Morgan over here that she's built different than the stock type horses, and these saddles work kind of across the board for me pretty well. So that's what I go
well,
with.
Well, I mean, like I was going to say, just because a saddle is $20,000 doesn't mean that it is what, I mean, I'm not going to knock the brand. They're gorgeous, and they are made quality. They're great, but you're not going to find that saddle out in a ranch, out in the middle of Wyoming, running across a couple of 100,000 acres. You're not, that's not practical for that job of a horse. So they're not any less. They're great. They're still great, if not probably better for functionality.
Sure. Well, and the thing is, you got to remember, if you're going to show in the ranch classes, especially if you're going to do any kind of ranch trail, or I mean, you're going to scuff that saddle. And so, you know, whatever you get, it's going to get marks on it. It's going to get some scuffs on it. And, you know, it's not going to stay looking pristine and brand new forever. And really, I think at the ranch, you don't want it to.
Right.
When you
ride
the pin to show in the ranch classes, I mean, I think it ought to, your shafts should look like they've been worn before. You know, your saddle should look like you've been riding for a while. Like if everything looks brand new, then it's very obvious when you ride in there that you are also brand new. Right. So it lends a little bit of credibility when you go in there and you look like you've been doing this for a while, you know? And so But I encourage my people to invest their money in quality, like buy quality headstalls, quality tack, quality saddles. You know, we try to use really good quality bits and stuff like that, but we don't get so concerned about, you know, any particular brand or any kind of, I mean, I've got certainly things that I like and go to a lot, but you know, if you've got a saddle that fits your horse and it works, you don't have to go buy another one. You know,
right.
And the trends aren't the trends don't change in the ranch on that stuff all that much. You know, it's not like in the all around world, you'll see where for several years, everybody's got a light colored saddle. And then it'll start to change, and then everybody will have a real dark oiled saddle. And then it'll kind of transition, and it just ebbs and flows like that quite a bit. And, you know, and you'll see there'll be little periods where they're almost completely covered in silver. And then you'll see where, you know, they don't have quite as much silver. It's a little more modest or whatever. And that stuff just ebbs and flows, and it kind of, those trends kind of just go around and change. And,
yeah.
You know, but for the ranch stuff, it's, you know.
Kind of like the passion part of it.
Yeah, and, you know, for the ranch stuff, the biggest thing is that you need to go in there with functional equipment.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and have your equipment adjusted properly and look like you know what you're doing. You know, don't let your back cinch hang down 2 feet below the horse's belly.
Yeah.
Don't have your breast collar so loose that it's hanging over the points of the shoulders and restricting their movement, or rubbing a bald spot on their chest. You know, other than that, it's not necessarily. You know, I've got saddles that we paid $5,000 for. I've got a saddle that I paid $1,000 for, and I've won several titles in the $1,000 saddle, won several titles in the expensive saddle. I don't know in our industry that's making that big of a difference other than that those fit the horse and allow the horse to really go show itself off and do its job. Nothing restrictive happening on that end, on the fit. But in terms of, you know, the old saddle, the $1,000 saddle, it's pretty worn. It looks pretty old. And,
yeah.
You know, but it still works. And it, you know, I've yet to have a judge like not place me well because they were like, oh, that saddle's old, he needs a better one.
Right. Yeah. I think you're preaching to the choir with that. I mean, like, mine was probably not even $500 and we won with it. It was like, you know, yeah. And we lost with it too. It has nothing to do with it. It's, you know, how you ride the horse or whatever, you know. But I think some people can kind of get caught up into that, which is fine. I mean, if that's what you want to get caught up into, but
well, again, like if you have that money and you want to spend,
go for it.
You want to spend that money and you want to get a custom set of shaps that are going to cost you $2,000. If you can afford to do that, that's great, but it's not necessary.
Right.
That's the whole thing is that, you know, it's not necessary. You can still go be extremely competitive in a, you know, $600 pair of shaps.
Yeah. Yeah.
$400 bucks. Yeah, but it needs to be functional.
Right.
That's what they're really looking for there. You know, and again, we talked about, like, with Romels, you can buy $1,000 set of Romels pretty easy, but they don't have to be. You know,
well, like I'm glad you brought that up. Whoa. You got to explain this to me, because I just had split reins. Like, it was nothing swanky. Mm-hmm. We just did split reins, and I didn't even use my reins. I used my spurs and my feet when I rode. So, What are these Romels? I'm not even saying it right. How do you say it?
So Romel is
Romel,
how we say it.
Okay.
Is how we say it around here. It can be pronounced differently in different regions.
Yeah.
Kind of like shaps and chaps. You know,
there's different. Yeah.
Or a Boswell or a Bosal, or some people just call it a Hackamore.
Bosal. You know, Boswell. Bosal.
A lot of it depends on what part of the country you're in, you know, in terms of how you pronounce this thing. But we call it a Romel. And it's essentially a single piece. It's like a single rein that'll be connected on the left, connected on the right, and then it comes up together, and it has these little, it's like a hobble. It's a little hobble, and that connects that piece, which is the two strands of the rein. It connects that to a single piece that you hold then in your free hand. And so that hobble allows that to, like, kind of swivel and move around. That's just a, you know, when I showed in the all-around stuff in the late 80s, early 90s, like, we showed horsemanship in a Romel. Like, that was just kind of the trend there. That's more the California Vaquero influence.
Ah.
kind of into that stuff. And so a lot of that, I think, I could be wrong, but my understanding is a lot of, like, the cow horse stuff was really California West Coast that had that heavy tradition of the vaquero influence. When a lot of those guys moved in, you know, over the years to Texas and Oklahoma, kind of brought those traditions with them. And mm-hmm. then that we kind of co-opt that, I guess you would say, into the ranch stuff. You can mm-hmm. ride in split rein in the ranch, and a lot of people do. But
I'm glad
you said
that, because this whole time I thought you had to have those things. You're not an idiot.
You can show in split reins, and sometimes I do, just depending on what horse I'm showing and what class I'm doing.
Yeah.
A lot of times if it's ranch trail and there's going to be a dismount ground tie thing, I'll show in split reins just because it's a lot easier to just step off and drop those reins than to unhook the bit hobble deal and drop the Romels down takes more effort. So a lot of times I'll just show in a split rein there. And it's perfectly acceptable to do it either way. I personally like the feel of a Romel. I like the mm-hmm. functionality of how that works. I feel like I can do more with my hand without it looking like I'm doing as much.
Now, so hold on. When you hold them, you have to have, all right, so you've got like, okay, so you know how in halter you have to hold if you're right-handed and you've got your hand on the end of, if you've got a shank on it or whatever you get and you've or a chain on it, you hold your hand at the end of the chain and then your left hand has to be in a certain place with the excess, right? Is that the same concept when you're holding those Romels, like you whichever hand you're driving with needs to stay in a certain position as well as your left hand needs to be in a certain
position,
rules. Right?
There are rules. So
okay.
when you show in a Romel, you have to hold that thing thumb up, and your fingers have to be closed. You're not allowed to stick any, unless you're showing in what they call a two-rein setup, which is a whole different deal. You can't put any fingers between those reins. So you're holding that with a closed fist in kind of a thumb-up position, whereas when you show in a split rein, your thumb is pointing towards the horse's ears.
Right.
So when you show in a Romel, your thumb is pointing more like up, straight up. And for me, that just changes the angles. Like when you steer, when you do things, it's just a little bit different. And like you can get, if you're willing to spend some money, you can get Romels that are very heavy.
Yeah.
And they're like braided rawhide ones with, you know, with the accents on them. I mean, they can make those where they've got a lot of weight to them. So when you lay it across that horse's neck, they really feel that, right? Because that is allowed versus a set of split reins that maybe you lay that across their neck and they don't act like they feel it as good. And, you know, again, it's a personal preference of just what's more comfortable to you and what you feel like. And most people that ride with me, most of my customers, first time I start them riding in a set of Romels, they hate it. They almost all hate it, and they think it's weird, and they don't like it. But after a while, as they progress, they start to go, oh, yeah, I like this better. This is cool. I want to keep using these. The thing about it is to use a set of Romels, your horse has to really be broke. They have to really be broke to the neck rein. You know, you can't cheat that.
Yeah, like, right, you can, right.
You know, a lot of people, if they're showing in a set of split reins and their horse doesn't go to the right as well, they'll have that right rein slightly shorter to help with that steering. You can't really fudge that in a Romel, you know.
Right.
You kind of have to close that hand around it, and what you got's what you got. And, you know, but again, a personal
hold on a second, because a lot of the pictures I have seen of people showing with them, okay, and I see the hand setup that you're talking about and all that kind of good stuff. It actually doesn't look like anything is neck reined, and I could be looking at it wrong. So do you need your legs in order to steer that animal with those reins?
So in my opinion, a horse should be able to steer just with your hand. or off of your feet.
Okay.
I think they need both. I try to teach my horses how to follow my legs, follow my feet, but I want to be able to override that system at any point and just take a hold with my hand and have that be enough. If you only use the leg cues and you don't teach the horse to truly neck rein, then when I put a kid on it that's 10 and hasn't been riding 6 months, they can't get it to do anything. Right?
Yeah,
so the horse needs to learn the neck rein, but then you refine that down and you teach them how to move with your legs and off your feet and your distribution of your weight and things like that, little tricks that we all use. But the basic ability to just move off the neck rein is still there. What it does is it creates a scenario by using your legs and your seat and your feet and all these things where you don't have to use your hand very much, and then that makes that horse appear to be more broke. Right? The less it looks like the rider has to do, the more it looks like the horse is broke.
Right. That's what I was seeing it as. I was like, okay,
yeah.
Well, if their hands
are
broken.
I mean, they are broke. It's not like it's an illusion. They are broke to be able to do that. To get one to move off and go around, it'd be like riding bridleless, you know, to get one to follow around and just ride with your legs, like they have to be broke. So it demonstrates the amount and the level of how broke that horse is, I guess, the better way to phrase that.
Yeah. All right. Now, let me ask you this. Now, I know that you and your wife have won quite a lot. You guys have won quite a lot of stuff. What's probably your biggest accomplishment to date?
Oh, that's tough. So I've got a couple of things. It's hard to pick one. I've got a couple of things that kind of stick with you. So obviously, like the first world title I ever won, like that one is a big. That's a big one. I mean, it's hard to. Hard to argue against that one as kind of being one of the biggest accomplishments. But there've been a couple things. One of the things that I'm probably the most proud of. So I showed the two full siblings that we have, High Caliber Gun and Frozen Heine, at the Appaloosa National Show in 2022. It was in Tulsa. And I won first and second in the senior ranch riding. Like, that was pretty cool. I came back the next year in 2023 in Oklahoma City, and I did it again. So being able to do that, and they were in the same order. So High Caliber Gun was first, Frozen Hunting was second, both times. And then went to the
Whoa, wait a second. So hold on. You can show. So is that by the horse and not by the rider?
Yes. You can. Well, different associations have different rules. So, but like you can show two or three horses. Certain associations don't even have a cap. Like you can show like the Ranch Horse Triple Crown. And as far as I know, they haven't changed the rules on that. So I think you can. I mean, you got seven of them. You can go show seven of them. The pattern class. They allow us to show multiple horses.
Yeah, yeah.
And so,
but the points are going to follow the horse, right? Not the rider. Not that's why you were able to do two.
Correct.
Very cool.
And so,
So
I went 1-2, and then went back the next year. Went 1-2, and then at the World Show, the Appaloosa World Show last year, they went 1-3.
Oh wow!
Almost got the 1-2, but like that back to back deal. To be able to do that twice on two different horses that ride very different, they're very different personalities, and that was kind of one of the things, like as a highlight of what I've accomplished. Like that's a pretty cool thing to have been able to have pulled off, and was not expecting that to work. So, but we leave.
Well, that is cool.
We haul in Tuesday. We go Tuesday this year, so we'll see if I can do it 3 years in a row. I bet I can't. But I'm going to try.
Well, now that you said, don't say nothing. Don't jinx it.
Well, I'm going to try. But I'm definitely not expecting it.
Now, are you and your wife competitive against each other, like play competitive or no?
Not really that much. Not so much with the horse show stuff. Like, we get competitive about stupid stuff.
Oh, okay.
You know, charades or, you know. we'll argue back and forth over who's right about a certain thing, and then we'll Google it and we'll both be wrong, you know, but like stuff like that. But in terms of that stuff, no, not really.
Yeah.
You know, I always have had the belief that a rising tide raises all ships. And so anytime you're around people who are successful and are doing well, that kind of rubs off, and you do. So we almost kind of feed on each other in that regard, you know? So like win something, and then she wins something, and then it just, I think that kind of builds, and then it builds into my program with all my other non-pros and stuff. Case in point, like this year at the Pinto World, so the open classes went first, then the amateur classes, then the youth classes, and the amateur walk trot classes, kind of all that followed. And so like that all just builds together. So I won the ranch riding, and actually was first and second in the ranch riding there too, but on the same two horses, but flip-flopped. But so I went 1-2, then Grace went in and she showed in the amateur ranch riding, and she won on the same horse I won on, and then she was fourth on the one I was second on. And then my customers come in, and like we just kept that rolling. So we won first and second, or first or second, in almost all of the ranch classes that I had customers in. And so I feel like that stuff, from a competition standpoint, that kind of feeds the machine, if you will.
Yeah, yeah.
But in terms of like, you know, we have had deals where, like if we've got two horses to show in the ranch rail, you can only show one. So a lot of times I'll show one, she'll show the other one. There's been a couple times that she's beat me, you know, and she'll give me like a little bit of something about it, but it's not really. We're not really like that competitive with each other. We kind of see ourselves as being a team in life. And so when she does something great, I'm happy, kind of vice versa. And then, you know, if anything, we're probably more critical of each other at this point. Like we'll go down and, you know, like I won the deal at the Pinto show, but one of the things in the class I was like, that was not super great. Like it was okay, but I had a really kind of a bad transition on one, and I came out and I was like, transition was bad, and she's like, yeah, it was really bad. And then, you know, she came back and she won, and the first thing I told her when she rode out, I was like, you didn't push for enough extended lope. She's like, well, I won. But you know, so we kind of have that relationship now where we have high expectations of each other, and so we push each other, and we will critique each other for sure. But it's not necessarily a competitiveness between the two of us.
Dude, I mean, you have to have somebody that's willing to be like what you guys are, you know, even if you win, like, hey, that's great you won, but by the way, this needs to be here, and this, you know, needs to be here. So that's a good thing to have.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, and even though she's just an amateur, like she's been doing this, well, I think she's been showing in the ranch classes since like 2014. So, I mean, we're 10 years she's been.
Oh, wow. Yeah,
so, you know, she's picked up stuff, and she's able to watch, and she knows what it's supposed to look like and what it looks like when it doesn't work right and all that. And so, you know, she's a good source of feedback.
Has she been doing the ranch longer than you?
She actually started doing the ranch classes before I did. I was still doing a lot of team roping and stuff. And that's kind of how I got kind of pulled that direction. So I didn't really start showing the ranch stuff until 2017 or 18. I kind of played around a little bit on a couple horses we owned. Didn't really get serious about it until like 2020 is kind of when I started getting serious about it. And then from there, you know, it's just snowballed. And I tried real hard to send her off. I sent her to a guy that trained some app ranch horses, and I sent her down there for a little while. And then I sent her to Bud Lyon for a little while. He had her mare for a couple of months, and then she was going and taking lessons and stuff. And, you know, I tried real hard to let somebody else do that, mostly because I was worried about, you know, the coaching, the wife, and all that dynamic.
Yeah.
And I've seen that go poorly in the past for other people, and so I tried to avoid that as much as I could, but it finally just kind of got to a point where it was like, okay, I got to help you do this. And then, of course, like with COVID and, you know, travel restrictions, and some of the shows happened, some of the shows didn't happen and all that. And so kind of at that point, I just kind of took over that role as being the primary trainer and doing all that. And then, like I said, it just kind of went from there.
Well, it worked out good. I mean, you know, but that is a good thing that you said. That could be kind of a detrimental thing depending on who the people are. You know, sometimes...
Well, I go back to, Chris Dawson, I heard him say this, and it just always has stuck with me since I heard him say it. He says, you should never teach anybody you've seen naked. And, you know, that goes for your spouses, it goes for your kids helping parents, you know, like that whole deal, like kids can't learn from their parents very well, and spouses don't learn from each other very good. And, you know, it's a good philosophy to live by, I think.
He is not wrong.
He is not wrong.
That guy has
so many good sayings. Like he should write a book of just like one liner sayings. Like he has so many good ones.
Don't teach anybody that you see naked.
Yeah.
I'm gonna have to write that down and hold on to that, because that's pretty good. That's like they say, don't there's the one good saying that goes, you know, don't shit where you eat. And it just kind of goes to show where, you know, you've got to be able to separate kind of work from personal. And that's one of the reasons why I don't show. And a lot of people have asked me if I was going to get into it and stuff of that nature. And since most of my work is associated around people that show and in the horse industry, I feel like it would be a conflict if I took that time to show and do that kind of stuff. And it can be. So that's always stuck in my head. Don't shit where you eat, or don't eat where you shit, you know.
Keep that stuff separated. Either way.